Blog Talk Radio.
Once again to Masonic Effects, a place where we can share my indulgence and my sense of, and a common sense of masonry, of being a Freemason. I find it hard to believe that I've been involved and finding such amazing satisfaction over the years, but still asking, you know, still finding new ways of wrinkling my forehead and wondering what it is that I'm learning and what is there to learn. It's a wonderful. Here I go. I'm thinking that it's bleak around me right now, and this is going to reveal perhaps too much information. It's bleak. The nature is outdoing itself with variations on gray and gloomy and oppressive kind of weather. It's all around. There's an upheaval. It's like the world has had enough of the party, the indifference to the things that matter most, and then we have more fundamental questions that aren't really suited to rash thinking or emotional reaction. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't any of this have been happening naturally? And you and I are just these benign little creatures that cut down the forest and alter the natural flow of things because we have that sense of detachment. After all, we are human, and some of us, as we are taught, are more superior in every way and can certainly dominate nature, don't you know? Except, it sounds silly. What is our act of contrition? What is there a penance? Is there an apology that will work? Well, apparently not. The place is burning, and when it's not burning, it's flooding. And I'm thinking that the bitterness that's going on in the world right now—it's always been there. It's undercurrents, and sometimes it's more vocal than others. But at some point, we will be tossing a coin and landing on the side of erring on the side of calm, trying to calm ourselves, trying to come to terms with what's happening around. Because in the big picture, there's not a lot that we do really control. That was somebody that taught us that was bluffing. They were making it up as they go along. We can influence, I think, yeah. We can live a good life. We can raise our children well. We can overcome difficulty. We can be good neighbors and contribute. But none of that really does work that well when we unleash the sense that of this eye for an eye or justification. I don't know where that comes from. That it's all a trigger. Of course, it begins to ooze Christian ideology. Here I am turning the other cheek. Well, in my sense, I think the other cheek is the other hemisphere of my brain. I'm trying to understand it. Because understanding and passivity is not cowardice or weakness. It took a long time to figure that out and to think objectively the way masonry allows is just sublime. It's wonderful. If you're inclined, and I think that the inclination is hard. The inclination is like realizing that we're going to look at the world and our lives in more detail than we had. And when we start to examine things, of course, we're going to see things that are unpleasant about ourselves. The one indication of maturity is that we acknowledge. That's all the scientific methodology, isn't it? You try something, you come up with an idea. It's just an idea, and you put it to the test. Do the facts support the idea? But the notion, the similarity is when we find things that don't make sense or are mistakes, and we admit them to ourselves. We admit error. Otherwise, we become those insufferable bores that you try to avoid at the party. That's willing to give you an hour about their exploits and how they're so much more competitive. Well, good luck with that. Huh? Anyway, today we have a good program. The commentary, Understanding in an Adversarial Age, carries on with this. We've broken down the convention quite a bit. And maybe we're harvesting the results of a secular world. I don't know what other word to use. We know that we can, if we're thinking tribally, we can employ religion as an excuse for war and anger and oppression. You can do that. A lot of lives have been ended for the sake in the name of religion. More so than I think than all those bloody pagans that run around so happy. We tried to kill them off and stop them from talking, but they're back. And they never did really go away. These thoughts never really disappear. They just become quiet. We're always in interesting times, but if you're at a point and there's no way of knowing that except by your own reaction, there are things to learn. And a world to explore, a world of meaning, and it's all right. It's all right when we begin to see the world as it is, like saying to our waking up in the morning, with all those occult notions running through your head. What am I mean? I'm thinking about alchemy and metaphysics and meditation, you know, all those the things that we do in polite company where we're exploring the edges, where we're challenging and raising doubt. We do that. Maybe I can do that with on a yoga mat in the lotus position or when I'm performing Tai Chi in the backyard. But More likely, I'm not going to share with anybody that I'm, it's curiosity, and I'm wondering about mystery and mystical practices, and more so, not that I could do it, because I kind of think, yeah, I can do those things if I have the motivation. But what would I learn from it? And my goodness, it's an interesting rule of thumb. I don't know if I go about my life doing things because I'm curious about what I'll learn. It's usually I can make anything joyous into a chore. And while I'm thinking, all those people over there that seem to be able to dig the hole and make the best of it and be enthusiastic and have healthy thoughts. And then over there is all that crowd, it seems like a bigger crowd, grumbling and annoyed and impatient, digging the same hole, but hearing themselves so bleak and discouraging. My goodness. I know I choose the one, but I seem to act more like the other. And I don't quite, those are the things that I don't quite follow. I don't quite understand that. So before I become too annoying for my own words, let's jump into the program a little earlier than usual today. Let's start with some of the poetry for the ear. This is music, of course. I don't think that I need to legitimate the approach of the program, but I will here. I'm just looking at some analysis of Pythagoras. I was talking about him last week with everybody here. The Pythagorean fundamentals. What a lovely phrase. Doesn't it catch your imagination? And immediately the study of geometry, music, and astronomy was considered essential to a rational understanding of God and man or nature, and no one could accompany Pythagoras as a disciple who was not thoroughly familiar with these sciences. Well, the meaning of it has changed, because we don't necessarily train people to teach our children to retain a lot of information, but to be able to access it. I remember the scandalous scandal when little hand calculators first came out. Well, how is the little offspring going to learn how to do sums, how to do arithmetic, if all he need do is push a button, do the calculations? What, we're teaching 8-year-olds to do algebra, punch in these buttons? How do we remember the discussions about analog and time? We're showing children never seeing a round clock face with the hands, but showing them a number. So 201 is exactly that. Now, what does it mean? On the clock face, we saw we had a different configuration. And we saw the whole day all the time on that clock face, didn't we? Mm-hmm. But what effect would this have on our children and next generations if they don't see that? Well, all we had to do is wait around and for finding out. Not a whole lot that's evident, but always there is an impact on thinking and brain. And I like to think that there's going to be clever kids come along that will make better use of that than analog. I don't drive around with a pocket compass. I have GPS, of course, doesn't everybody just bounce signals off the satellite and that shows them the road ahead on whatever scale they decide? It's a different form of mathematics, but nevertheless. and the music, we can now ask ourselves, we don't have the impediment of needing to put in a huge pipe organ into our lodge. We can bring the sound. We can bring Bach to our services, to our meetings. Every time you want to Chopin, bring Chopin with you. You want Mozart, bring him. Beethoven, absolutely. Haydn, go ahead. But, you know, I'm not going to get maudlin about when the music stopped. But there's things about us before that were still quite beneficial today. Music being one of them. And I like to think that we've made some progress and we can do things that the ancients might not have had such a time to do. Now we have access, and that's lovely. And I think if you're looking at ritual, Masonic ritual, it does speak to us about access to understanding. Now that isn't that just simply incredible? But how would you do that without boring the doors off the barn? I think is how we learn tolerance. It's like the old Japanese proverb that talks about a man learning patience by pressing the button at the elevator. I thought it was very, very apt. You know, what do you see? How many times you went up and just repeatedly pressed it? Like, you know, yeah. The equipment's working, so, but it doesn't make it faster if you repeat, you know, press, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Well, the crosswalk at the street lights, just keep pressing it. We learn patience in lodge. It's helpful if somebody says, "Hey, look, this is where we learn tolerance." Then we learn to identify first, not with what we with disagreement, but what we find that we can agree about with the thoughts and opinions and perspectives of other people. Oh, and at the end of the hour, we call that tolerance. And we add a sense or a challenge of doing it with a sense of grace. Nobody makes you live with grace. You notice it, realize, it's that simple, then I'll do it too. If you have that sense that that's the way you'd like to live, or that there's that knowing that it appeals to so many people and it allows people to see your confidence, the confidence not to be the first and the loudest, you know, all that brashness. So we've seen that how many times. But the confidence to listen, to pay attention to what another person is saying. Without that need to, that weakness, that insecurity that prompts dominance. That's a curious when it happens, and then you know person gains that reputation. Yeah, we all have reputations, impressions that we leave on people around us. So our taste in music is not your taste in music or his taste in music, but the joy, the way that he shows us the joy in his music. And may be reminiscent of what we feel when we listen to music, privacy of our chambers. All of that we share with them. We bring inspiration to people that struggle with inspiration. And lately I've been rereading, and it's fascinating, and I suggest to you, my goodness, do this if you're tend to be close-minded or fundamentalist, you're not going to like what I'm going to say next, so maybe you need to leave the room. But if you read Ritual, to examine it for occult notions, oh my goodness, you find them. Yeah. It's like reading it with that sense. You give yourself that sense or that task or that focus. I'm going to focus on the metaphysics. It's like focusing on the shaping the note or the timing of it or the volume of it. And easy enough for us to use these thoughts because they're hanging above us in these tassels, you know. The one that I've been fascinated with lately is about temperance. No, it's timing. And not the temperance, intemperate, or temperance league, that kind of notion, carry nation and stuff. No, no. This is temperance is timing, patience. Pythagoras was not an extremist, so says this more knowledgeable writer. He taught moderation in all things rather than excess in anything, for he believed that an excess of virtue was in itself a vice. Oh, isn't that true? One of his favorite statements was, "We must avoid with our utmost endeavor and amputate with fire and sword and by all other means from the body sickness, from the soul, ignorance, from the belly, luxury, from a city, sedition, from a family, discord, and from all things, excess." Huh. Upstart. Sit back, enjoy, relax with me. Thank you. Bill Evans. Charming. Charming. It's always wonderful to listen to it. Even a understanding in an adversarial age, this is my attempt to speak with us and to wait for your response, to talk with you. Even a quick run through Masonic ritual is enough to remind us learning to turn the other cheek is not a simple act. Matthew 5:39. But beneath the surface is one of the most interesting and effective ways to earn respect. Put it out there and it comes back to you in spades. It is next to impossible to find a comment from another person that does not contain at least a sliver that is agreeable. If you take the time to look for it. Continuing to listen and agreeing in part when feeling provoked is not that difficult if a person is generally honest. When you were honest with yourself, yeah, when you were imagining the experience of an enlightened thought, didn't you once imagine lodges could be like this? Didn't you imagine your thinking would be valued, that judgment would be in an atmosphere dominated by patience and understanding? You're not likely to feel comfortable showing that side of your character if you're not sensing the trust. Neither is the majority of brethren around you who, like you, have a notion of what they want to do. They do, but lack the mechanics. They will pour out their hearts to a stranger, but be unable to do the same with their life partner at home. It's made bartending a much respected, enduring craft. Every day, men are being bombarded with messaging that weighs on their guilt and distress. So it is understandable they would be guarded around strangers because they need to keep their guard up to avoid being completely overwhelmed with the psychology of guilt and blame. It became much worse when charities discovered the psychology of giving. It's easy for a plea on behalf of an innocent victim of circumstance to be unrelenting as bully tactics are applied. A few simple statistics at the right time, all it takes to have people reach for their wallet to make it all go away. Or you could do the arithmetic of understanding laid out in front of you in Masonic ritual. Oh, damn that ritual. It's a hell of a lot safer to learn life skills that have been validated. Work with ideas that have withstood the test of time. It means that they're not old ideas, that they're valid. But there's so much fundamental hesitance. Easier to distract. Oh, isn't it easier to distract from that tedium to, and you wouldn't want a steady diet. It's like anything, you need to do it in moderation. You need to probe the darkness in moderation. But when the moment comes, whether it's that spontaneous meeting on the couch where you're sitting around after a lodge meeting and the conversation just flows. How are you? It goes from, hi, how are you? And who are you? And what about that? And then the night goes on and somebody puts some music around you and poof, it becomes special. Can we orchestrate or schedule spontaneity? Nah. Nah. But we can remind ourselves that's what we're trying to achieve. want to hear that extemporaneous reveal. The parts of the conversation, and you're thinking that, tell me about you. It's all those little bits in between the big points that you make that tell us who we are to each other. They explain it to each other. Here. Here we have a way of thinking that needs to be attenuated, because it can be off-putting, especially if you're not sharing the conversation, really. And if I think about all the things that I'm told each day that is important, somewhere in the recesses of my mind, I have the notion that everything is important all the time, except I'm not that focused. If my purpose is to be inclusive, then that's a matter of my attitude and consistency. We'll get around to it. You may not be the person speaking a great deal that day, but that person may have something useful to say and to contribute. How we debrief, it's important. It's important the way we decide to put a value on those. But it's the deciding point. The tipping point is when we have intelligent conversation. Doesn't really matter the topic, yeah? Intelligent minds make something out of the experience, and that's part of the beauty. All men know what they want, says, according to the Pythagorean notions. Pythagoras warned his disciples that when they prayed, they should not pray for themselves. That when they asked things of the gods, they should not ask things for themselves, because no man knows what is good for him. And it is for this reason undesirable to ask for things which, if obtained, would only prove to be injurious. The god of Pythagoras was the monad, or the one, that is everything. He described God as the supreme mind distributed throughout all parts of the universe, the cause of all things, the intelligence of all things, the power within all things. He further declared the motion of God to be circular, the body of God to be composed of the substance of light, and the nature of God to be composed of the substance of truth. Hey, buddy. Haven't I heard bits of this in ritual? Are you saying that if I'm accepting this premise of light into darkness, strive for greater understanding? It's a thought experiment, isn't it? Yeah. And then I learn how to do that either through my behavior or my manner toward others or my own thoughts. Here he simply says, that's God. That's God in my belief. You don't have to believe it. And then the nature is the nature of God to be composed of the substance of truth. Well, I make a number of obligations, and I've wondered why, if I make one obligation, take one oath, why I need to repeat it, and why I would go to other appended orders searching for something if I haven't done study first. Perhaps the answers to what I'm searching for are right under my nose, and I haven't looked. I've been looking for the shortcuts. When Pythagoras decided, as he often did, to retire into the temple of God for an extended period of time to meditate and pray, he took with him a supply of specially prepared food and drink. The food consisted of equal parts of the seeds of poppy and sesame, the skin of the sea onion from which the juice had been thoroughly extracted, the flour of daffodil, of leaves of mallows, and the paste of barley and peas. These he compounded together with the addition of wild honey. For a beverage, he took the seeds of cucumbers, dried raisins with seeds removed, the flowers of coriander, the seeds of mallows and purslane, scraped cheese, meal, and cream, mixed together and sweetened with wild honey. Pythagoras claimed that this was the diet of Hercules while wandering in the Libyan desert and was according to the formula given to that hero by the goddess Ceres herself. Thank you. This is a time in the show where I mean, talk about poetry, poets, and share a poem with you. Today, it's a bit, for me, it's a bit special, and I'm of that so-called baby boomer generation, and part of that was and is defined by the material we were reading at the time and we were sharing. And I'll tell you the story. The poet that I'm going to share with you, we're going to talk about today, is a fellow named C.S. Lewis. He was a very, very interesting man. Very, very interesting man. But and he was an English poet. And I want to talk to you about his participation. You can do some of that research on your own if you're inclined. But I want to talk to you about maybe a lesser known part of Lewis's background. He was one of the Inklings. This was and the Inklings were an informal literary discussion group associated with J.R.R. Tolkien. Yeah, that one, Lord of the Rings Tolkien. And it operated out of Oxford University for nearly two decades between the early 30s and late 1949. They were literary enthusiasts who prayed the value of narrative in fiction and encouraged the writing of fantasy. Now, apart from Tolkien, there was C.S. Lewis, Charles Williams, and Owen Barfield. We know about the writers, and Tolkien's son Christopher was part of it. He was an English and French academic editor, and the editor of much of his father's posthumously published work. Tolkien drew the original maps for his father's The Lord of the Rings, if you're wondering. You've heard. J.R.R. was John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. He was a writer and a poet and a philologist and academic, and he was best known for the high fantasy works, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Enter the 60s, reading in the 60s and 70s. Now, Warren Lewis was the elder brother of the poet that we're going to share today, Clive Staples Lewis, C.S. Lewis, a British writer and lay theologian. And he held an academic positions in English literature at both Oxford and Cambridge University. He's best known for his works, the Screwtape Letters and the Chronicles of Narnia and the Space Trilogy. Interesting guy. No, his brother Warren was an Irish historian and officer in the British Army. He's best known as the elder brother and he was a supply officer for the Royal Army Service Corps in the First World War. And then Robert Harvard, just to give you a sense, Dr. Robert Emlyn Harvard was the physician of C.S. Lewis, his wife Joy Gresham, and J.R.R. Tolkien. Harvard was also credited as a skilled and prolific writer. Now, we know this was a small group, and they met regularly. But the story I want to tell you today, you can check this out. It's a lovely story, and I tend to think that it's true. These writers would bring their material and they would read their unfinished works. That was sort of the purpose, the principal purpose. But there were no officers and structures and no rules and agendas or formal. It was, you know, when you sit around with thoughtful people, it just seems to come. You don't need all of that. It's like, oh, here we go again. Is somebody going to minute this? Like, why would you bother? It's like you're going to forget. No. So they would read it. And while Tolkien was, the story that I'm going to share, Tolkien was working on Lord of the Rings. And the group was getting tired of listening to him. Yeah. Because he was editing and re-editing, and he finished the work, and he would bring back the edits, and he would read it to the group, and they comment and talk about it, until the point where they got fed up, and they said, "Oh, good God, you know, not again, you know, Jay, John, just let it go," and he couldn't. He you know, he couldn't. How many painters, how many writers, how many artists are like that? They just can't let their baby go. So the story goes that the group made a reason that would get Tolkien out of his house. And when he left, C.S. Lewis went over to his house and broke in, searched through the house, found the manuscript, and took it and presented it to a publisher. Presented it to a publisher and then went to the man, told him what they'd done. Now, of course, the outcome of that is history. Of course, you don't, who had ever seen anything, you know, unprecedented? And Tolkien was then Tolkien, known to the likes of me and you. But that's the kind of guy he was. And that's the kind of group it was. It was like his work was that good. And these weren't amateurs. These were some of the finest literary academics that you could find on the planet, arguably. And when they said something was good and didn't need any more, and they realized, they all realized, because they'd all experienced what Tolkien was going through. It's never going to end because it's never good enough. So they stole it. He stole it. I love this story. I love it. It's so charming. And I think, well, what did I don't know the reaction. Did he, you know, a little fist pumping and say, what the hell are you doing? You know, broke into my, what did you do? Well, I made you famous here, you silly. But it wasn't Lewis alone that would say that. It was the Inklings. And if you were driving us mad and we told you and you couldn't stop, and every time we met, you would come back with this. And it's like, oh, enough. And it was brilliant. Let's do it. He later said, when Tolkien left Oxford during 1933, this Inkling Society ended, and Tolkien and Lewis transferred its name to their group at Magdalen College. You know, if you're teaching at Oxford, you need to be a member of a college. And I forget how many, what is there, 67 colleges or something? I'm not sure. And on the association between the two Inkling Society, Tolkien later said, although our habit was to read aloud compositions of various kinds and lengths, this association and its habit would in fact have come into being at that time, whether the original short-lived club had ever existed or not. Humble man. It's just such a, you know, people, writers would share. That's what he's really telling us, hey? So, the late 1949 year I was born, Inkling's readings and discussions usually occurred during Thursday evenings at C.S. Lewis's college rooms at Magdalen College, of course. And the Inklings and friends were also known to informally gather on Tuesdays at midday at a local public house, the Eagle and Child, familiarly and alliteratively known to the Oxford community as the Bird and Baby, or simply the Bird. The publican, Charlie Blagrove, permitted Lewis and his friends to use the use of his private parlor for privacy. And the wall and door separating it from the public bar were removed in 1962. And later pub meetings were at the Lamb and Flag across the street. And in earlier years, the Inklings also met irregularly at yet other pubs, but the Eagle and Child, the Bird, is the best known. Yeah, interesting man. The poem today, we listen to it because I believe, as many do, that reading and writing poetry both engage our senses along with our emotions, making the art form experiential and hugely effective in connecting with our minds. The experience, the point of masonry, the experience. And through its expression of feelings and words, it tends to be highly therapeutic and has that effect on the mind. But the structure of a poem favors brevity, and yet the best poems also capture succinct detail, making them incredibly powerful in getting a message across to the reader. It requires, and I think, you know, this isn't for I think this talks to a mature mind. Poetry requires us to be open and honest about our feelings so that we can voice them through a pen and paper. And this is the first step to truly expressing ourselves. And don't underestimate that, my brethren. Write down your thought, however random it might be. Write it down. It's the first way that we gain control over these beasts, these beastie things. The best poetry is written when we're truly in the midst of our emotions and struggling to gain clarity. Just start writing. Just start writing. And here, we'll come back to the work of Keats. We just have to. And of course, with the holidays, the solstice coming up, I need to tuck into a bit of the occult. But here, listen to this. This is C.S. Lewis's work. And I think you'll find that this is on being human. Oh, why not? Why not tackle it? Angelic minds, they say, by simple intelligence, behold the forms of nature. They discern unerringly the archetypes, all of verities which mortals lack or indirectly learn. Parent in primordial truth, unvarying, pure earthness, and right stonehood from their clear high eminence are seen. Unveiled and seminal, huge principles appear. The tree-ness of the tree, they now know the meaning of arboreal life, how from earth's salty lap the solar beam uplifts it, all the holiness enacted by leaves fall and rising sap, but never an angel knows the knife-edged severance of sun from shadow where the trees begin, the blessed cool at every pore caressing us. An angel has no skin. They see the form of air, but mortals breathing it, drink the whole summer down into the breast. The lavish pinks, the field new mown, the ravishing sea smells, the wood fire smoke that whispers rest, the tremor of the rippled pool of memory, that from each smell in widening circle goes. The pleasure and the pang, can angels measure it? An angel has no nose. The nourishing of life and how it flourishes on death and why they utterly know, but not the hill-born earthy spring, the dark cold bilberries, the ripe peach from the southern wall, still hot, full-bellied tankards, foamy topped, the delicate half-lyric lamb, a new loaf's billowy curves, porridge, nor the tingling taste of oranges. An angel has no nerves. Far richer they. I know the senses' witchery guards us like air from heavens too big to see. Eminent death to man, that barbed solemnity and dazzling edge of beauty unsheathed would be. Yet here within this tiny charmed interior, this parlor of the brain, their maker shares with living men some secrets in a privacy forever ours, not theirs. Why history, eh? Why bother? Why bother? I'm becoming a stronger believer the value of our traditions, Masonic traditions. And the way that we respect them and teach them is by shown in the care we give to the execution of them. It's not for any one person to take this on. This is what we do in how we use the friendliness that we created in a lodge. We friendly, and so we can do things together that angrier men cannot. And why would we bother going back? Well, what does it teach us? Maybe it's not for me to tell you these are the specifics and the highlights. Perhaps one day I'll begin to do that. I tend to like to own a subject before I feel confident about sharing my thoughts with others. By owning it, I need to have a personal understanding of it. And I'm one of those people that can't seem to fragment my understanding. It's either it's all, you know, and then it's never quite complete. But I need to understand the shape of an idea. And I'll hesitate. And it's not something I do on purpose, my goodness. Here we're talking about, say, you know, 18th century stuff. Now, are there overlaps? I tend to think there are with, and it is in a way like looking at, through a portal back at ourselves and then turning and looking quickly into a mirror. As the boys of the day, Grandmaster Dutch Freemasonry, embraced a new sociability, these relatively elite brothers found themselves at odds with the upholders of other values, cultural, but also, as the Nijmegen controversy reveals, political. If you didn't like something and you had political muscle, you could really you can persecute the people involved. Still goes on today. Forced to defend themselves, the Nijmegen Freemasons responded boldly to their accusers. Yeah. A club of friends, a group of friends. Repeatedly, they reiterated their love and respectful awe for the divinity. Because the politics of the day put the theologians at their heels. These were heretics. Make up a story and attack. Which is not the same thing, they observed, as banishing all. They were in awe of divinity. Not the same as banishing all religion and daring to speak neither of God nor of the commandments. What annoyed the outside world was this notion that we don't speak about politics and we don't speak about religion when we're in a tiled lodge. Because it's a way of helping to identify the common purpose, not the distinctions of division. It's not to say that we don't think or we don't have our own perspectives when we walk into a lodge. But the outside world saw this, especially the literalists, the fundamentalists, saw this as a condemning one of their practices. Here you don't talk about it. Well, of course you do. You should, or you're not a good practitioner. Forced to defend themselves, they responded boldly. And they said that we do respect. Clearly, it would appear that they have been accused of doing just that. You know, you're banishing all religion and you're daring to speak neither of God nor of the commandments. They defended their good manners against, it would seem, charges of excess, noting that in all states and communities and assemblies, one can find the good and the bad. So don't pick on us. But the Freemasons also went after their attackers in language that reflected their own cultural and political values, accused the consistory of the local church of acting, in effect, in an ableist fashion and of an usurpation of the legislative power and of laying the foundations of hierarchy and the Inquisition, both of which, in a clear reference to the revolution against Spain, their ancestors had struggled to shake off. They further accused the ministers of having a curious delicacy of conscience that would exclude the brothers Merckx from the local church, but that could find nothing wrong with the participants of the East and West Indies Company who have a rapport with the slave trade. This is a rare reference, however obliquely negative, to the slave trade, a topic seldom mentioned in Dutch publications of the period. We talk about the so-called dangers, the dangers presented. We'll pick this up again. Do you see the point? Do you see the point? They're really talking. This part of our history, this part of our common history, tells us that there's there's distortions, and that no amount of disclosure is going to end that distortion, and so we might as well just be and practice our faiths and our continue our practices and know that we are generous and charitable and understanding, and that we know how to listen, but that we're also not stupid. We're also not stupid. But does that go on today? Yeah, it does. It does. I cringe every time I hear a thoughtless Mason making jokes about, you know, the goat and things like that, bringing up criticism about the comparison of us with a cult at a time when Christianity was making the word occult a bad thing, with sinister, you know, malevolent practices. And people still believe that stuff to this day. And so why would one of our brethren think that it was a joke to bring it up? It's like thoughtless, man. It's like, it's reminding us of pain. Anyway, here, check this out. That's it for today. That's it. You've had enough of me. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in. I appreciate sitting down with you and sharing some ideas. Maybe you'll think a little more kindly of the program, knowing that, you know, we toy with the ideas of Pythagoras here. He liked music, and I like music, and he said, here's a guy that taught that friendship was the truest and nearest perfect of all relationships. So as you're listening here, I hope you'll hear that this feeble attempt to have a friendly conversation with you, to welcome you into a bit of my thinking, and to strive to help you feel relaxed, and perhaps you can walk away with an idea, or you've been satisfied. Maybe it's just this beautiful, beautiful music. But go about your business and think of yourselves and look for the and know that you know the principles and virtues of Freemasonry are important, and know that you are able to allow them to influence your thinking to ever advance your sense of understanding, that you're more today than you were yesterday. And each day we work on slight improvements. Eh? Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you again soon. Thank you.